The so-called quantification settlement agreement belies many years of legal wrangling. San Diego will eventually receive one-third of its water from the Imperial Irrigation District, with the district using the income from the sale, now about $60 million annually, to line canals to prevent water losses and improve irrigation techniques in order to save the transferred water. Sounds like a pretty good deal. Win-win. But as with all things water, this resolution has one gaping hole, or more aptly, drain. The backstory begins over a century ago, in 1905, when the original Imperial canals breached and the water from the Colorado River poured into the Salton Sink, just north of the Imperial Valley. This escaped river water flowed for 2 years, after which the designation sink was no longer sufficiently descriptive of this reservoir. It was now the Salton Sea, accidental, shallow, its maximum depth is only 50 feet, sitting at 230 feet below sea level, and twice as salty as the ocean, the largest lake in California, almost twice the size of Lake Tahoe, and home to more than 400 species of birds, an important stop on the Pacific Migratory Bird Flyway. During the 1950s, the newish lake was a famous resort destination, with attractions named Desert Shores and Bombay Beach. However, the shallow reservoir in the hot desert was extremely susceptible to loss through evaporation. The only source of replenishment was runoff from Imperial Valley agriculture, and the 2003 water transfer agreement with the big cities required Imperial to provide it to the tune of 1.2 million acre-feet per year. Fallowing fields produced most of this water. There are two big catches, though. First, this runoff is loaded with fertilizer, pesticides, and salts, further increasing the sea's salinity and killing fish and water birds. When the California State Legislature approved the 2003 agreement between Imperial and the urban interests, it also agreed to develop and fund a plan to restore the Salton Sea, and not just as a wildlife habitat, but also for the health of nearby residents. In 2007, the California Natural Resources Agency recommended an $8.9 billion project. The stunning price tag for full restoration essentially stalled any restoration. Even a recent study by the Pacific Institute estimating that continued inaction could cost up to $70 billion in reduced property values, public health costs, and decreased agricultural productivity over the life of the 2003 agreement could not move the needle. Nothing happened. Meanwhile, Imperial County, the political entity, not the irrigation district, sued the district over the negative impacts the water transfers would have on the Salton Sea. Several environmental groups filed separate actions. In 2014, the irrigation district went so far as to decree a halt to future water transfers to San Diego if the state did not abide by its own agreement to protect the embattled Salton Sea. The following year, the county and the water district laid down their legal weapons and jointly developed a $3 billion restoration plan. Much of that money would go toward boosting geothermal energy development. The lake is home to one of the world's most potent geothermal reservoirs, and local officials have long seen new development as a source of royalty payments to fund long-term restoration. New geothermal plants would also suppress airborne dust by covering portions of the exposed lake bed with the power facilities, not to mention contributing to California's lauded clean energy mandate. 50% renewable energy by 2030. Complicating matters was a 2015 report by the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, a widely respected federally funded lab in Colorado, suggesting that Salton Sea energy development could generate far less revenue than previously estimated. California might need more geothermal plants to meet its goals, but for now, state and federal policies favor solar and wind farms, which are much cheaper. The second catch is about the tainted runoff. Imperial's legal obligation to provide it ends in 2017. On January 1st, 2018, mitigation flows will cease, causing the sea to shrink more rapidly and hastening the decline of its water quality. Slowly but surely, more than 50,000 acres of lakebed silt and fine-grained soil particles tainted with farm field sediments will be exposed, posing an urgent threat to residents in the Imperial Valley and the nearby Coachella Valley as well. Given the persistent desert winds drawn across this vast playa, the fine airborne dust and toxins will only increase what are already among the highest rates for children's asthma ER visits and hospitalizations in the state. Foreseeing this eventuality, Governor Brown's 2016 budget included $80.5 million for restoring the sea, a pittance compared with the $8.9 billion recommended a decade earlier, but a decent start, all things considered. Private philanthropic foundations are collaborating to raise an additional $10 million. In March 2017, California released a 10-year, $383 million plan to begin the first phase of restoration. Funding is assured for only the initial 3 years, but the upside is significant. The state has identified a timeline and cost estimate for specific projects. Finally, the Salton Sea crisis is getting long-deserved attention, and just in time, because time is running short. The lack of a restoration plan has affected drought contingency planning. The Imperial Irrigation District is reluctant to sign any deal for temporary reduction of Colorado River water supplies until there is a real strategy to resolve the air pollution and environmental harm at the Salton Sea. Further hindering these lower basin negotiations, the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California is reluctant to agree to cutbacks in its share of the Colorado River supplies until the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta issues are resolved, and it knows how much Delta water it will get. As is so often the case with water and the West, it's a complex situation. But one point is clear. With mitigation flows ending in 2018, California must act quickly to protect both the Salton Sea and the health of local residents. Maybe it is time to bring back the decades-old proposal to pipe seawater to the Salton Lake bed from either the Sea of Cortez, also known as the Gulf of California, or the Pacific Ocean. Both are more than 100 miles away, but this old idea of tapping the Sea of Cortez specifically has a trickle of new life because its seawater is already flowing through a canal to the southern side of Laguna Salada, a barren lakebed 25 miles away and below sea level. Since the north side of the laguna is still dry, expanding the canal could fill it. This end of the lake is a mere 40 miles south of the Salton Sea. Piping water across the border into the Salton could work. Since any plausible action regarding the Salton Sea is now more limited in scope than refilling the lake to its historic levels, such a sea-to-sea solution might not be a completely insane fantasy. By the end of the long journey from its snowy headwaters, the Colorado River is stretched to its breaking point. Just below the spot where the borders of California, Arizona, and Mexico meet, the Morelos Dam, the last and final concrete obstruction on the main stem of the river, diverts every last drop of water for the residents and farmers of Mexicali Valley. The river simply stops right there. The channel below the dam is a dry, flat bed of sand. Only in a really wet flood year did the river flow beyond the dam and reach its delta and the Sea of Cortez. This hasn't happened since the winter of 1998. And given the enormous amount of unused storage capacity upstream in Lake Mead, such an uncontrolled flood may never happen again. However, on March 23, 2014, the gates of the Morelos Dam opened for a one-time release of the river into its former channel. The water flowed for 8 weeks, and on May 16th, reached the Sea of Cortez for the first time in 16 years. 23 miles below the dam in San Luis Rio, Colorado, once an important port for steamers traveling up the Colorado from the Sea of Cortez, water flowed once more under the high bridge built decades earlier to cross the original river. Adults gathered to marvel at a sight they had never expected to see again. Kids and teenagers played in the river waters for the first time in their lives. Several adventurers rode that first pulse of water for more than 30 miles on stand-up paddleboards and in canoes. Pete McBride, 5 years earlier, had hiked the same route down the last 90 miles of the dry river channel, through choked tamarisk brush, enduring temperatures of 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Now he was back at the scene, on his paddleboard. What was going on with this one-time return of the Colorado River to its delta? A landmark agreement between Mexico and the United States, known as Minute 319, signed in November 2012, a late addendum to the 1944 treaty that defined how Mexico and the United States would share Colorado River water in wet and dry years. Mexico's official allocation, 1.5 million acre-feet. Minute 319 allows Mexico to store water in Lake Mead for future use, comparable to the surplus system available to the lower basin states under the interim guidelines. Following a 7.2 magnitude tremor that struck the Mexicali area on Easter Sunday, 2010, creating havoc and damaging hundreds of miles of irrigation canals, the United States had agreed to store some of Mexico's water in Lake Mead on an emergency basis. Other important stipulations were the return of 158,000 acre-feet of water over 5 years to the Colorado River in Mexico, and expanded restoration efforts in the Delta region. Two-thirds of this new water would be released in this one-time pulse flow, mimicking a springtime flood, complements of Mexico and the United States. The subsequent one-third would occur in smaller base flows provided by the Colorado River Delta Water Trust, formed by NGOs Pro Natura Noreste in Mexico and the Sonoran Institute and the Environmental Defense Fund in the United States. This water would be secured by purchasing rights from willing sellers in the Mexicali Valley. The cost? $10 million. The Nature Conservancy, the Redford Center, and the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation joined the campaign to raise the money. In a mock public service announcement for this Raise the River campaign, Will Ferrell and surfer Kelly Slater proposed to Robert Redford that instead of raising the river, they should move the ocean. In 2016, Raise the River reached the $10 million goal. Releasing water down the desiccated Colorado River channel, though a powerful symbol, will not restore the entire delta. The goal is to reclaim enough water to selectively recreate the delta's ecosystems, riparian woodlands, brackish marshes, mudflats, in an evocatively labeled Emerald Necklace of Biodiversity. The base flows purchased from Mexicali irrigation canals will be channeled directly to the restoration sites instead of using the former riverbed. The first of these is about 10 miles downstream from the Morelos Dam, near the community of Miguel Alemán, where the invasive salt cedar that thrives in dry sandy areas was removed from 500 acres, chosen as a riparian restoration site because of its shallow groundwater. Cottonwood and willow seedlings are being planted. Water piped from an irrigation canal will support these youngsters until their roots can reach the groundwater. The goal is to plant 100,000 native trees by 2017. By the end of 2015, just over 40,000 trees were planted. Further downstream, at Laguna Grande, rich riparian habitat and marsh now replaces 160 acres of the dry salt cedar stands. The planted native vegetation, nurtured by the base flows, supports abundant birds and wildlife. The Sonoran Institute hopes to restore 750 acres total and create the densest stand of native vegetation on the Colorado River in Mexico. As it happens, the largest wetland in the Delta region was an accidental creation. In the 1970s, when salty wastewater from Arizona degraded the quality of the Colorado River water delivered to Mexico, the Bureau of Reclamation built a 60-mile canal to send the water straight into the delta instead. Today, the result is La Ciénaga de Santa Clara, a 40,000-acre wetland surrounded by vast stretches of barren, desiccated mudflats. These cattail and bulrush marshes and lagoons now receive a little over 100,000 acre-feet of the water per year from that canal. It is a major stopover for migrating waterfowl. Now, this inadvertent oasis is threatened because the irrigation wastewater destined for La Ciénaga de Santa Clara flows past the Yuma desalting plant. Completed in 1992, this plant operated for 9 months at one-third capacity until a flood shut it down. It stayed that way for 17 years. In 2010, the Bureau fired it up at one-third capacity to find out whether it could be recommissioned, which would be bad news for La Ciénaga. Instead, good news. Running the legacy plant was very expensive. $16 million for the 10 months of operation at 30% capacity, or almost $500 per acre foot. And the facility needs $25 to $50 million of upgrades as well. The economics of the project are questionable at best. For now, the irrigation wastewater continues to bypass the plant and instead sustain the marshes, lagoons, and waterfowl of La Ciénaga de Santa Clara. That plant should be permanently mothballed. Just as mitigation flows from the Imperial Valley to the Salton Sea are scheduled to cease on December 31st, 2017, causing all manner of problems for the Salton Sea, the return of Colorado flows in Mexico, stipulated by Minute 319, are scheduled to end on the same date. Given the early successes with the restoration projects, and the fact that extending the agreement would continue Mexico's right to store water in Lake Mead, propping up the lake's level to prevent triggering water curtailments, there are reasons to hope that the agreement will be extended through 2026. On the other hand, President Trump's immigration policies and his pursuit of a border wall could prove a huge obstacle in these negotiations. We shall see. Right now, we know that sharing water in the desert southwest between all parties, urban populations, and irrigated agriculture, when climate change may further decrease water supplies, is a tall order. Minute 319 and the several agreements among the competing jurisdictions to the north light the way forward to a new era, with collaboration replacing competition and litigation in allocating water in the American West. Damned salmon, damned dams. In the 20th century, dams civilized the American West, Hoover, Shasta, Grand Coulee, Bonneville, and Fort Peck in Montana, all built in the 1930s, are edifices of enormous proportions, engineering masterpieces, and symbolic achievements. Hundreds more went up in the 1950s and 1960s, none quite as ambitious as the earlier ones. They brought irrigation, electricity, and eventually millions of people. And they wreaked havoc on the environment. On this front, the 21st century news is, perhaps surprisingly, pretty good in one respect, but very bad in another. The century-old passion for building large dams with colossal government subsidies to entice farmers and ranchers to settle arid lands and make the desert bloom and cattle multiply is finally over. Huge construction projects subsidized almost entirely by the federal or state government are financial relics from our profligate past. Besides the best sites, narrow river canyons with stable geology in unpopulated areas are already taken. This is good news. On the other hand, the ongoing impact of the existing dams on the future of wild salmon is dire indeed. To be fair, dams and their reservoirs do permit unimaginable numbers of people to inhabit forbiddingly arid regions, and floodplains for that matter, where big cities would be washed away without upstream protection. Sacramento, for example, sits on the banks of the Sacramento River. In 1862, before the first dams and levees, during the wettest California winter on record, until this year, The Sacramento was wider than the eye could see, 30 miles wide. But the protection systems built to move such floodwaters rapidly to the ocean are now, when every drop of fresh water is precious, obscenely out of date. The extreme high tides and larger winter storms caused by climate change will further test the limits of this 20th century infrastructure. In fact, it's already happening. The record-breaking snow and rain in early 2017 pushed at least two dams in California beyond their limits. One story was local. At Anderson Dam, above San Jose, heavy rain filled the reservoir, and water thundered over its spillway, flooding parts of San Jose along Coyote Creek. 10,000 residents evacuated. This dam sits next to the Calaveras Fault, which has a 26% chance of causing a large earthquake by 2043, according to the USGS. Because of this seismic vulnerability, the reservoir is not supposed to exceed 68% of its storage capacity. The other story was big news nationally, even internationally. At Oroville Dam in the Sierra Nevada foothills, 75 miles north of Sacramento, high water releases caused the main spillway to fracture in two. At 770 feet, the dam is the tallest in the United States, and Lake Oroville above it is the state's second largest reservoir, and the linchpin in the state water project that delivers water to 25 million Californians and thousands of acres of agriculture. In the first weeks of 2017, Lake Oroville received record water inflows thanks to an exceptional series of back-to-back Pineapple Express storms. In order to create space for future inflows into the lake, dam operators were obliged to send water down the spillway. Half a mile long and as wide as a 15-lane freeway, this concrete channel runs from the top of the dam down to the Feather River. The crisis started with a pothole, albeit a big one, the size of a football field, with as much as 100,000 cubic feet of water per second. That's more than the volume of Niagara Falls, being released from the lake to control its level. The surge over several days severed the structure in two, blew out a good section of the spillway's right wall, carved a gaping ravine next to the spillway, and propelled a huge volume of mud and rocks into the Feather River. Initially, the biggest threat was to the state fish hatchery, which raises half the salmon caught off the California coast. It was only 4 miles downstream. Millions of salmon and steelhead could have been killed by that extremely muddy, oxygen-deprived water. In 48 hours, managers rapidly evacuated 5 million juvenile salmon to another facility downriver. Next, the Butte County Sheriff, fearing failure of the emergency spillway, which would release a wall of water 30 feet high, inundating Oroville, Marysville, and Yuba City downstream, ordered 188,000 residents to flee for higher ground. Luckily, that flood never occurred because dam operators reopened the damaged main spillway, and there was a fortuitous break in the weather. By 2025, 70% of the 90,000 dams in the United States will be more than 50 years old. Built to less rigorous engineering standards, they may not withstand large floods or earthquakes. Oroville Dam's concrete spillway is relatively young, only 48 years in age. Its potential failure horrifyingly illustrates the risks around the country. None of the dams in the United States are on the short list of most dangerous on the planet, but this is not much to brag about. About 15,000, just under 20% of the total, are deemed by the Army Corps of Engineers National Inventory of Dams to pose significant hazards, including loss of life and serious economic impacts, should they fail. That's what did happen at the Teton Dam on Idaho's Snake River in 1976 and the St. Francis Dam northwest of Los Angeles in 1928. Sooner or later, every reservoir silts up, and it necessarily follows that the storage capacity is correspondingly diminished. In California, scientists estimate that sedimentation has now decreased the state's reservoir capacity by 4.5%, or 1.7 million acre-feet of water, with about 200 reservoirs having lost half their storage. And trapping that sediment behind dams cuts off the natural flow that would rebuild beaches and wetlands, increasingly important defenses as sea levels rise. With sufficient sedimentation, the dam that created the reservoir is not just useless, but potentially a threat to everyone downriver. Water plus sediment produces a more dangerous flood than just water. Exhibit A is, or was, the San Clemente Dam and Reservoir on the Carmel River on California's Monterey Peninsula. Out of commission since 2002, it was 95% full of mud and sediment, the equivalent of 125,000 truckloads. Dam safety experts declared San Clemente a seismic hazard in 1992, more than two decades ago. In late 2015, the 10-story-high concrete arch dam was finally removed, the largest dam removal in the state thus far, to prevent its potential collapse in the event of a large flood or earthquake. And what is in all that sediment lodged behind dams over many decades? Since the discovery of gold in California in 1848, mining operations have used an estimated 26 million pounds of quicksilver, mercury, to extract the ore, with 10 million pounds of this toxic liquid metal washing into streams, rivers, and reservoirs as mining sediment, virtually all of it in the Sierra Nevada. Could one increase the storage capacity of these reservoirs by removing and cleaning the sediment to yield sand and gravel? The gravel could be used to restore salmon and steelhead habitats, and at the same time finding mercury and even some gold? A pilot project at the Combi Reservoir on the Bear River, a tributary of the Feather River, is going to find out. Decreasing efficiency of water storage and increased risk of catastrophic failure are two of the issues facing our dams. In the West, the third issue has become the most pressing of all. The dams are pushing salmon and certain other species to the edge of extinction. Blocked passage to spawning habitats and reduced water flows have caused these populations to plummet. Even dams equipped with fish ladders to help adult salmon swim upstream may lack measures to get the young fish safely back downstream. Now, drought and climate change make conditions even worse, with greatly reduced stream flows and warmer water temperatures at critical moments in the salmon life cycle. Over 20 years ago, the first salmon listed as endangered was the Sacramento River Winter Run Chinook. A few years later, in 1998, defying the dam-building legacy of his predecessors, Secretary of the Interior Bruce Babbitt swung the first sledgehammer to bring down McFerrin Dam on Butte Creek, a Sierra Nevada stream. It and three other dams on the creek were the first in the West ever removed solely for the sake of salmon. One day after the McFerrin event, Babbitt unpacked his sledgehammer in downtown Medford, Oregon, to breach Bear Creek Dam, the first removed in the Pacific Northwest to protect coho salmon. Those demolitions were an encouraging beginning, necessary but hardly sufficient, and progress over the last three decades has been spotty. The fish continue to face myriad challenges in their struggle for survival. Nearly 30% of the populations of six species of salmon are gone. More than a third of the remaining species, 17 Chinook, coho, sockeye, and chum salmon, 10 coastal steelhead, are federally listed as threatened or endangered. A new report predicts that if we let current conditions continue, California will lose 45% of its salmon and steelhead in the next 50 years. Logging, livestock grazing, and diversions for irrigation have wrecked a lot of spawning habitat. But this loss is not the only problem. In watershed after watershed, much of this habitat is still usable, if not exactly thriving. It's just that the fish can no longer reach it. In the Columbia River Basin in the Pacific Northwest, more than 400 dams without fish ladders or other attempts to improve survival prevent salmon and steelhead from reaching 40% of their original habitat. In California, more than 80% of the spawning reaches that salmonids accessed in the old days, before the gold rush, are now blocked by impassable dams. To save salmon, we must leave more water flowing in rivers and streams. We must also dismantle some dams. Additionally, the water in the creeks and rivers must be the right water, good and cold. In 2016, the National Marine Fisheries Service, now labeled NOAA Fisheries, reported that only 3% of the Sacramento River's winter-run juvenile salmon survived the overly warm water below California's Shasta Dam. A year earlier, 5% survived. In 2011, before the drought began, 41% of the juveniles survived. And these abysmal survival rates are for those juveniles reaching the Red Bluff Diversion Dam, which is not their ultimate destination. They have another 160 miles to go before arriving at the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta and eventually the Pacific Ocean. NOAA Fisheries estimates that only 1% will make it all the way. Federal law requires the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation to hold enough water behind Shasta Dam to release cold flows critical to successful salmon spawning in the Sacramento River. In 2014 and 2015, the Bureau failed to do this. The first year's disaster was blamed on a faulty temperature sensor, which somehow was not correctly remedied by the following year. Another issue was significant deliveries to holders of senior water rights in the upper Sacramento Valley. These virtually mandatory diversions diminished the cold water behind the dam. The Bureau responded by revising its Shasta temperature management plan twice in 2016, limiting releases in order to preserve cold water for the winter-run Chinook. We can only hope these efforts succeeded, because 2016 was a critical year. Since the fish spawn on a 3-year cycle, a third year of unusually warm and shallow water could essentially end the winter-run Chinook. With extinction of the winter-run Chinook a strong possibility, fishery managers were forced to restrict the ocean fishery in 2016. While fishermen on the ocean mostly catch the relatively abundant fall-run, hatchery-raised fish, wild winter-run salmon also swim in the same waters. Imposing tighter restrictions on all salmon fishing in Northern California waters is therefore necessary to ensure that the endangered fish are not eliminated. The 2016 cutback threw the coastal fishing economy, already reeling from the closure of the Dungeness crab season due to dangerous levels of the neurotoxin domoic acid, into further turmoil. Unfortunately, the 2016 restriction was not the first of its kind. 8 years earlier, managers had closed commercial and recreational salmon fishing in California and Oregon due to the sudden collapse of the Sacramento River Chinook salmon and the poor status of coastal coho salmon. In preceding seasons, 800,000 Chinook were typically caught. The devastating economic impact of the closure caused the three West Coast governors to ask for $290 million in disaster relief. Congress responded with $170 million. Salmon fishing season was closed again in 2009. Since initial estimates for 2017 salmon populations do not look good, fishing limits are in some areas even stricter this year than last, especially for the Klamath River. A second double whammy for the fishermen in less than a decade? That's a crisis. Imagine farmers' outrage if they had to shut down their entire operations and fallow their fields for 2 years in a row. To save salmon, we must certainly leave more water, cold water, flowing in rivers and streams. But dams are equally the problem. Is it a coincidence that Butte Creek, where Bruce Babbitt initiated the demolition of the four dams, is now one of only three Sacramento tributaries that still harbor a sustaining population of spring-run Chinook, and indeed has the largest run in California? Hardly. The demolition of the dams is the reason. In 1999, a year after those dams were dismantled. Removal of the Edwards Dam, on the other side of the country, opened Maine's Kennebec River from the city of Waterville to the sea for the first time in more than 160 years. Migratory fish immediately returned in astonishing numbers, including 2 million alewives. As mentioned, in California, the seismically dangerous San Clemente Dam was fully demolished in late 2015. In 2016, the old Carmel River Dam, a 32-foot-high structure less than a mile downstream from the San Clemente Dam, came down. The two actions have literally opened the way for the threatened Central California coastal steelhead. Within months, steelhead reds, spawning nests, appeared for the first time in nearly a century. The largest dam removal project in the world has transformed Washington's Elwha River, which runs 45 miles from the temperate rainforest in Olympic National Park to the Strait of San Juan de Fuca before flowing into Puget Sound. For nearly a century, two dams on the river, the Elwha Dam, 108 feet high, and Glynn's Canyon Dam, 2,010 feet high, built in 1910 and 1926 respectively, provided electricity to the booming lumber mills in nearby Port Angeles. They also blocked the native salmon runs, essential to the culture of the lower Elwha Klallam tribe, which argued to no avail that its fishing rights, granted long before the construction of the dams, were useless because the dams had eliminated the salmon. Over time, as adequate, affordable electrical power came online from other sources, the primary need for the dams dwindled, and the Elwha tribe and sympathetic environmental groups began advocating for restoration of the river and its salmon runs. Responding to their petitions, Congress passed, and President George H.W. Bush signed a law in 1992 allowing the federal government to buy the dams and study the feasibility of their removal. Finally, 2 decades later, in September 2011, President Barack Obama's Secretary of the Interior, Ken Salazar, members of the U.S. Senate and House, Washington Governor Christine Gregoire, tribal leaders, and other supporters gathered for a ceremony to mark the beginning of the restoration of the free-flowing Elwha. A mere 6 months was required to remove the dam. A 4-minute time-lapse YouTube video documents the job. The neighboring Glynn's Canyon Dam was gone by August 2014, and almost 3 years to the day from the ceremony, the Elwha River ran freely to the sea. Tons of silt, trapped behind the dams, flowed downstream to nourish the river mouth and create 70 acres of new beaches. Salmon returned to the upper reaches of the Elwha for the first time in a century. In October 2011, the 125-foot-tall Condit Dam on the White Salmon River, one of the last tributaries to the Columbia River in southwestern Washington, was breached to restore a salmon river, and 6 months later, the 12-story structure was gone. In Oregon, the Rogue River now runs freely for 157 miles to the ocean after four dams were removed between 2007 and 2010. The Sandy River, a tributary of the Columbia that flows through Portland, lost three dams between 2007 and 2013. Now four dams on the lower Snake River in southwest Washington may be up for demolition because a federal judge has found the government's plan fails to protect the river's salmon and steelhead and must be overhauled, including consideration of the removal of the dams. Eliminating them would open thousands of miles of historic salmon habitat in Idaho, high-elevation cold-water reaches that would be critical as our climate warms. From Washington to Maine, dams are coming down, and the river protection group, American Rivers, is keeping score. 1,300 demolished altogether, over 800 in the last 15 years, 430 since 2010. There cannot be too many brought low, nor too soon. Dan Beard, commissioner of the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation under President Bill Clinton, has even called for tearing down Glynn's Canyon Dam in Arizona, as well as abolishing the Bureau of Reclamation itself. A provocative gesture, but likely to remain just that, a gesture. also unlikely to come down as Hetch Hetchy in Yosemite, though good arguments for removal have been made in both cases. These gargantuan dams will likely remain in place, but removing smaller dams, especially on salmon rivers, is more politically plausible and makes better sense in economic terms. The successes result from decades-long struggles through negotiation, litigation, financing, federal dam relicensing, and congressional sparring. These endeavors bring together federal and state government agencies, elected officials, local property owners, farmers, ranchers, power companies, commercial and recreational fishers, native tribes, and environmental organizations. Imagine getting that crowd to agree on how to change a light bulb, let alone how to take down a dam. And yet it's happening. Sometimes it's not even necessary to demolish the concrete. The nation's most ambitious salmon restoration project will not remove a single dam, but, if successful, will be an equally iconic achievement. The subject is the San Joaquin River, the longest in Central California. Originating high in the southern Sierra Nevada, the San Joaquin once supported one of the state's largest salmon runs. Then the World War II-era Friant Dam, near Fresno, designed for irrigation purposes, dried up 60 miles of the river and wiped out the spring and fall run Chinook. In the late 1980s, environmental organizations, led by the National Resources Defense Council, sued the Bureau of Reclamation and the Friant Water Users Association to restore flows to the dewatered stretch of river in order to boost the dwindling salmon populations. The lawsuit was finally settled in 2006, with a plan to refill the dry riverbed and restore it to a more natural condition all the way to its downstream confluence with the Merced River, provide fish passage around dams and canals, thereby reviving the salmon runs, all while minimizing water supply impacts on Friant farmers. Deliveries reduced by only 15% on average. In 2009, Congress approved the settlement and set in motion the San Joaquin River Restoration Project. Restoration flows were to commence in 2014. In the early stages of the job, the reintroduction of salmon would depend on the work of reclamation and state biologists who would truck the adults upstream across sections they could not navigate, then 3 to 5 months later, capture and truck their offspring downstream to locations from which they would have a fighting chance of swimming to the sea. Successful completion of the project was originally anticipated by the end of 2016, with the dry river restored, the salmon reviving, and then thriving. But the timing for the restoration turned out to be terrible. The impact of the statewide drought became overwhelming everywhere. No water was released for the San Joaquin restoration in 2014 or 2015. Facing reality, the federal and state government agencies implementing the settlement extended the deadline for restoration to 2030 and revised the estimated cost from $1 billion to $1.5 billion. As the drought made water supplies less reliable for the San Joaquin Valley farmers who signed the settlement, the restoration project lost even their minimal support. The big rains during the 2016-2017 winter may help, at least in the short term, because water-filled floodplains provide juvenile salmon an endless buffet of nourishment and protection from predators. Moreover, the restoration could be at a turning point with construction for a key bypass for salmon around the Mendota Pond, a major diversion point for irrigation, starting this year. Ultimately, though, it remains to be seen if this audacious restoration of a living San Joaquin River and its salmon run will be God's work or a fool's errand. This brings us to the notorious saga of the Klamath River salmon fishery. Recent battles in this watershed epitomize the head-on collision of 20th-century water policy with 21st-century environmental and economic reality. The Klamath flows through 263 miles southwest from the high desert of southern Oregon through the redwoods in northern California to the Pacific Ocean. The river is a main migration highway for salmon and steelhead from the ocean to their spawning grounds. Historically, this was the third most productive salmon system in the United States, after the Columbia and Sacramento rivers. In its long-lost natural state, the upper river basin was largely marshes and wetlands, magnificent waterfall habitat. Then in the early 20th century, the Bureau of Reclamation followed its operative template like elsewhere in the West and began constructing dams to provide low-cost power to irrigators and canals to divert water to the farms and rangelands in south-central Oregon and north-central California. 180,000 acres of grain, alfalfa, onions, potatoes, horseradish, and cattle. The resulting six dams are now owned and operated by Pacific Corps. The irrigators' very first contract with the project bestowed electricity on them at the very generous cost of 0.6 cents per kilowatt hour. In 1956, the rate was renewed at that same price for another 50 years. With the contract nearing its end at the turn of the century, the average statewide price for electricity in California was about 10 cents per kilowatt hour. In Oregon, it was just under 5 cents per kilowatt hour. In both states, the Klamath farmers and ranchers were getting their water and electricity almost for free, and almost in perpetuity. The Klamath dams, ranging in height from 33 to 173 feet, quite effectively make the upper river and its tributaries inaccessible to Chinook and Coho salmon. They've also hurt water quality. In the summer, stagnant pools of warm water behind the dams become a breeding ground for algal blooms of cyanobacteria, which form huge, sickeningly green mats in the reservoirs. Even an uncaring bystander realizes that this scene can't be right. Finally, the largest single tributary to the Klamath, the Upper Trinity River, had been virtually removed from the Klamath drainage in 1963, when construction of the Lewiston and Trinity dams diverted 90% of its flow to the Sacramento River and the Central Valley Project. In the spring of 2001, following 2 years of drought, the Bureau of Reclamation moved to protect endangered and threatened fish species by closing the headgates to a major irrigation canal, shutting off water to 90% of the farmers in the Klamath Basin. Farmers and ranchers unsuccessfully fought the Bureau's uncharacteristic move in court, and then took matters into their own hands, literally. In a made-for-media moment, more than 18,000 outraged farmers, ranchers, and their supporters held a symbolic bucket brigade protest in Klamath Falls, Oregon, passing buckets of water from the upper Klamath Lake to the main irrigation canal. Four times that summer, this alliance turned the water back on, using wrenches and even a chainsaw and blowtorch. Four times, local authorities stood by passively. Four times, U.S. Marshals and other federal agents showed up to shut the canal. And then this intense Old West frontier-style battle petered out as the irrigation season waned and the horrific September 11 terrorist attacks changed the world forever. The next spring, Secretary of the Interior Gail Norton presided over a ceremony at Klamath Falls to restore full irrigation to farmers, angering the salmon fishing industry, Native American tribes, and environmentalists. That fall, 33,000 salmon perished from gill rot due to low and warm water levels, the largest die-off ever in the West. 4 years later, in 2006, the power contracts that guaranteed irrigators dirt-cheap electricity were finally, after 50 years, up for renewal. Pacific Corps proposed a tenfold increase in the price. Suddenly, the electricity provided by the Klamath dams wasn't such a good deal. The following year, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, ruled that fish ladders must be built on the Klamath before the dams could be relicensed. And these were estimated to cost as much as $100 million more than the cost of dam demolition and purchasing replacement electric power. Pacific Corps had to seriously consider whether continuing to operate the dams was good for its bottom line. With electricity prices slated to increase dramatically, the Klamath farmers and ranchers also had good reason to reassess whether the dams were worth it. Of course, the local tribes and the commercial salmon industry had wanted the dams removed for many years. In frustration and desperation, a large number of these longtime adversaries began several years of prolonged, hard negotiation to see if they could resolve the Klamath crisis. And they succeeded. In 2010, the parties ended a century of bitter acrimony and actual conflict by signing two historic agreements, including the largest dam removal agreement in American history. The lower four of the six Klamath dams would be demolished, opening up hundreds of miles of salmon habitat. The demolition deadline was 2020, giving Pacific Corps a decade to assess a 2% surcharge on its electricity customers to cover removal costs. The farmers would give up some of their irrigated water in return for guaranteed smaller diversions. The river would be rehabilitated, and salmon would be reintroduced in the river's upper reaches. In dry years, water would be shared. These landmark agreements did not resolve all Klamath matters. Some ranchers in the upper Klamath Basin, one tribe, and several environmental groups were not in support, and the agreements needed congressional approval, not an insignificant challenge. Perhaps unsurprisingly, Congress failed to act on the agreements. Then, in 2013, another water shortage forced some of those non-supporters to reconsider. This was part of the big regional drought that brought low the San Joaquin restoration. And then, at almost the same time, an all-important legal ruling changed everything. Like so many of the big rivers, including the Colorado, the Sacramento, and the San Joaquin, the Klamath is over-allocated on paper. When water is insufficient to fulfill the numbers, senior water rights holders get their share, and juniors can be cut off. In March 2013, after 38 years of adjudication, Oregon recognized the Klamath tribes, the Klamath, Modoc, and Yahooskin people, as the most senior water rights holders for time immemorial in the upper Klamath Basin. Stunned ranchers in the upper basin had believed their claims were senior. In June, the tribes, fearing the drought, would decimate their traditional fishery of endangered Lost River and short-nosed suckers, exercised their rights to keep their water in the lake and upper tributaries. For the first time since the settling of the region in the late 19th century, hundreds of upper basin cattle ranchers and other junior water users, including federal wildlife refuges and parks, were cut off. Even Crater Lake National Park in southern Oregon was forced to truck in drinking water for campers. Ron Wyden, the three-time U.S. Senator from Oregon, and members of Oregon's congressional delegation called for a new task force of the key parties to bring the ranchers into the agreement, reduce the overall costs, and solve the water crisis once and for all. As if water crises are ever resolved once and for all. The resulting April 2014 agreement required the ranchers to cut irrigation from the Klamath tributaries by 30,000 acre-feet a year, entailing the retirement of 20% to 30% of their land. Any larger land retirement might ruin the ranching economy. In return for these concessions, the remaining ranchers would enjoy the security of knowing that under most conditions, they'd receive enough water to continue operations. Oregon Senators Wyden and Jeff Merkley and California Senators Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer introduced legislation to authorize the agreements. Republican Representatives Greg Walden of Oregon and Doug LaMalfa of California led the opposition because they opposed any and all dam removal. Regrettably, the opposition prevailed in 2014 and then again in 2015. The agreements expired at the end of that year. Without congressional action, the years of negotiation seemed in vain. Then, through surprising maneuvers, the supporters got the dam removal and restoration project back on track through means that did not require congressional approval. In an April 2016 ceremony at the mouth of the Klamath River, complete with salmon baking over a beach campfire. Secretary of the Interior, Sally Jewell, Oregon Governor Kate Brown, California Governor Jerry Brown, NOAA Administrator Catherine Sullivan, and Stephon Bird, the CEO of Pacific Corps, signed an agreement to decommission the four dams through the FERC administrative process. Pacific Corps will provide $200 million from its surcharge on customers, and California will provide $250 million from its 2014 water bond. No further federal expenses will be necessary. Maybe, finally, the Klamath River and its salmon populations will go forward to their past glory. But the dams don't come down until 2020, with a new Trump administration, where everything environmental is being reconsidered. If not reversed, the Klamath could be in danger again. Those opposed to the Klamath dam removal have sympathizers throughout the West. Dams always have their evangelists, and probably always will. Certainly the current drought, this winter's floods notwithstanding, makes dams and their reservoirs more appealing to those continually seeking more water storage. Right now, politicians and farmers in California's Central Valley, emboldened by the record precipitation of 2016 and 2017, are pursuing two new dams, sites in the Sacramento Valley and Temperance Flat above Friant Dam in the San Joaquin Valley. These Central Valley dams would be expensive propositions, each now estimated to cost from $3 billion to $4 billion, and the users of the water would have to finance almost the entire construction, with the resulting water exponentially more expensive than today's going rates. These proposals will be subjected to financial, environmental, and political scrutiny, unlike anything encountered by the old-time dam boosters. A far, far cheaper water storage option in times of torrential precipitation is groundwater recharge using expanded floodplains. These dams will probably never be built. I'll go further. Any new dam that someone somewhere is busy dreaming about definitely should and probably will remain just that, a dream. Besides, Oroville Dam's epic spillway failure is a wake-up call. We should fix the dams at risk of failure now rather than build new ones. Rebuilding the spillways and other repairs at Oroville will likely cost over $500 million. San Luis Dam, the earthen dam in Merced County that provides crucial storage for California state and federal water projects, has long been acknowledged to risk failure in an earthquake. If we really need more storage, maybe we should raise its height during the required seismic retrofitting. Governor Brown included this project in his latest list of key infrastructure projects submitted to the National Governors Association. But repairing an existing dam is nowhere as exciting as building something new and humongous. The old dams were built for irrigation, urban water supply, flood control, and power generation. In the 21st century, we can achieve all of these without erecting dams. Urban users are reducing their water use. Farmers could conserve much more with proper incentives. Clean energy, solar, wind, can supply electricity. Yes, hydroelectricity is also renewable, but the required dams on big rivers cause significant environmental destruction. Groundwater recharge basins and expanded floodplains along rivers will protect against floods, store water, and improve wetland habitats, especially for young salmon. In the American West, building new dams is antiquated, nor would new reservoirs make it rain or snow. California, wetter wets and drier dries. In early 2017, a phalanx of super wet storms walloped California. These so-called Pineapple Expresses saved the state from entering a sixth consecutive year of drought. Cause for celebration, but with this all-important qualification, full reservoirs and a healthy snowpack do not and cannot end the state's continual water woes. Nor does this winter erase a five-year drought or reverse the long-term decline in groundwater, a critical supply, especially during drought. California enjoys a Mediterranean climate, complete with the most variable rainfall year to year in the entire nation. Rain simply does not fall from May to December, and in much of the state, one-third of all precipitation falls in only 5 to 10 wet days in the winter. Debilitating droughts are guaranteed. Some will be short, as in 1976 to 1977, some lengthy,